Good afternoon and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. John Paul here today, sitting in for Celeste Quinn for a couple of days. Nice cooler weather in the Midwest. We hope you're enjoying the cooler weather, and we'll take a break with us this afternoon on AM 580 for the Afternoon Magazine. We'll be talking today with a man named William McGowan, who's written a book called Coloring the Press, or Coloring the News. You know, it's been pretty easy in recent years to pick on the press. I think many might call it a kill-the-messenger type of a syndrome. You know, you don't like what you see or hear or read in the news. Well, it must be a problem with the journalists. Media bashing seems to have become pretty popular in recent years, with attacks on journalists for slanting the news politically, of course, depending on your perspective, and misreporting or hyping the news for the sake of ratings or dollars. Now a new approach to telling you why your news isn't as it should be, and the author is William McGowan. Welcome to William McGowan today on the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. How are you? Thanks
Good.
For...
By the way, you missed the subtitle of the book. The title is Coloring the News. The subtitle is How Crusading for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism. And I don't put the book in the category of press bashing. It's a very, very sober work of social criticism that is about the media, that is incidentally media criticism and is very critical of the press. But I think it's a little bit of an oversimplification to say that Coloring the News is an example of press bashing, so to speak.
But I do get the feeling after reading the book that you have some pointed criticism for the things you read in the paper and that we see on the news or hear on the news. When it comes to the issue of diversity and especially on social issues, explain that for us.
Well, the reason why I wrote Coloring the News, and I think this answers your question, is that I became very concerned with the quality of information that the public was getting on a whole cluster of issues related to the broad issue of diversity. And among those issues, in that cluster of issues, the issues were race, gay rights, feminism, affirmative action, and immigration. I think mostly through the 1990s, which we could characterize as the decade of diversity, a lot of the news information that the public was getting, both through newspapers and through broadcast journalism, was faulty. And I think was overly smitten with a romantic view of diversity and really wasn't looking at the implications of diversity as it affected sort of nitty-gritty realities on the ground. And I pursued the research on this and decided to, basically to expand what was magazine criticism, magazine journalism, and essays on the subject into a book.
Your background, Bill, is in writing for Newsweek, BBC, The New York Times, Washington Post, Journalism Review. And you regularly contribute still to the Wall Street Journal. Is that true?
That's correct. I started out in daily journalism as a researcher and a reporter for the old McNeil-Lair Report. I've written, for almost all the national publications as a freelancer. I've worked for Newsweek International as a foreign correspondent. I was an editor at the Washington Monthly, and as you say, I am a regular contributor of the Wall Street Journal.
Well, let us let our listeners in today and give them the opportunity to speak with you about this issue of diversity and corruption of American journalism. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, we welcome your calls today to the Afternoon Magazine at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And from elsewhere in the AM 580 listening area, you can call 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Again, I guess the point, and I've been in some newsrooms too, it would seem as though, and I guess this goes contradictory to common beliefs, that diversity in a newsroom is a good thing, that it actually reaches out to maybe some unserved or underserved areas of the community.
Right. Well, I say that in the book. I actually say that diversity is a good thing, that the good news about the diversity crusade in the media over the last 10 years is that it's opened up the doors to a lot of talented minority journalists, and it's widened the radar screen with which news organizations monitor their very fast, demographically fast-changing communities. However, the bad news about diversity is that it's also opened up the door to a kind of skew or slant in the coverage, and that skew and slant in the coverage is marked by ethnic and racial hypersensitivity, group favoritism, a kind of cultural relativism, a sort of very kind of avoidance and denial of harder, uncomfortable realities that contradict the liberal agenda. And I guess in sum, all of the other things that we kind of, for lack of a better term, call political correctness. This is the problem. I have no problem with the actual effort to increase ranks of minority journalists, but I don't like the political correctness that is that has marked the reporting on sensitive diversity-related issues that's come in the wake of that. Now, I don't blame minority journalists for that in the least, because I think there are plenty of kind of flaccid-minded, you know, sort of liberal, white, male, middle managers who are just as responsible for this problem.
Well, I guess the point here is you then say that, well, I guess give us an example of what you think would be an overt case here of where diversity has skewed the story.
Well, I think if you look at, coverage of immigration, for instance, I mean, immigration has been a hot button, a very vexing social issue out there in the public at large. But if you look at how immigration gets covered in news reporting in most mainstream news organizations, both print and broadcast, you tend to see a fairly favorable and even romantic view of immigration that contradicts a lot of base realities of about the immigration issue today. I think prior to 9/11, there was a great deal of resistance to really looking at, for instance, the holes and weaknesses in the immigration system that were allowing people that we didn't want here in America, i.e. terrorists and international criminals, to come and go virtually as they please and to set up shop beneath the radar and to do dastardly things. I think since 9/11, we've seen a lot of good catch-up reporting. We've learned, you know, about the dysfunction in the visa system. We've learned about the ease with which terrorists can gain false identities through phony Social Security numbers and through phony state-level driver's licenses. We've seen articles about, various problems with pre-screening passengers coming in through international airports. But since 9/11, you know, this kind of politically correct script that accents a certain kind of left liberal take on immigration has survived in the form of a great deal of solicitude and hypersensitivity towards Muslims and Arab Americans that imagines America to be this horrible, backlashing, xenophobic nation and looking for scapegoats at 9/11 instead of very sensibly pursuing policies that will hopefully thwart terrorist activities in the future.
And I know you have other issues, too, that we'll get into in a few minutes. We do have a caller who wants to talk to you, line one from Champaign. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I guess I certainly identify with the some of the ridiculous hypersensitivity that shows up in the media. I think some of it was interesting to watch during the Olympics when they were trying to say that the first black woman had won a Winter Olympic medal, but instead they said that the first African-American woman won an Olympic medal, and it wasn't clear to me whether that was the first black American or the first black or what, and I think it eventually turned out that they were trying to be so politically correct that they were actually saying that, yes, neither a black woman from France or any other state or any other country had ever won a Winter Olympic medal. I guess one of the things that distresses me is that the hypersensitivity also leads to an enforcement of some of the left liberal stereotypes that show up, that and people start to believe that because the media is being so hypersensitive in reporting certain things, that some problems are actually much worse than they really are, including, you know, the abductions of children. People might think that thousands of children are abducted every day, when in fact the numbers are actually extremely small, especially when the abductor is not a family member. How can we basically let the media know, since they don't want to listen to ordinary Americans, that we're smarter than this and we actually would prefer more objective journalism and don't need to be spoon-fed what their particular sensitive issue is?
All right, William.
Well, it is hard to get through to a lot of people in the press. There's, you know, they get inundated by calls and complaints, and so they adopt, I think, a very shut down, resistant to criticism kind of attitude. But I think, you know, with enough letters and with enough phone calls, they do sort of, you know, start to get it. Basically, readers and viewers and consumers in general of news have been getting through or making their point known by essentially voting with their feet and opting out of mainstream news coverage. and acting on an attraction to alternative sources to news, whether that be the internet, whether it be talk radio, or whether it be, you know, upstart rivals like Fox, upstart, you know, networks like Fox, and Fox is hardly an upstart at this point since it's the number one in cable news. But I think that people, you know, generally can get their points across by looking outside of the traditional loop.
Are there feedback mechanisms whereby financially there will be a disincentive to continue that sort of reporting?
Well, eventually, I mean, any news executive worth his or her salt is going to, you know, see that there's an erosion of readers or viewers. Whether they're going to acknowledge that this might be tied to the tide of political correctness that's washing through newsrooms, I don't know. I mean, that's one of the things that's really difficult to get people to sort of acknowledge, is that basically newsrooms have grown out of touch with ground realities as most people live them. I mean, there's an article in the Washington Post today by Howie Kurtz, who incidentally has not reported at all on coloring the news, even though it's ultimately, you know, it's eminently newsworthy to do so. But he has an interesting piece, column about the fate of street reporters, metro columnists, street columnists at the nation's larger daily newspapers. And the point is made in the piece that, you know, essentially these metro reporters, you know, the likes of like Jimmy Breslin and, you know, Mike Barnicle and Mike Royko, you know, the old style street columnists, is basically lost out to a kind of, you know, wishy-washy, demographically correct and politically correct, ethnically correct, you know, generational successor who basically people don't read as ardently because they just simply haven't tapped into the lives of ordinary people as those people live them. That basically that they feel that, you know, the people can sniff through, you know, the kind of ersatz reality, the kind of scripted politically correct reality that a lot of journalists put forward.
Okay, thanks for your call. Again, we're talking with William McGowan, the author of Coloring the News, How Crusading for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism. Again, your calls in the Champaign-Urbana area at 333-WILL, that's 9455, and from outside the Champaign-Urbana area at 800-222-WILL 9455. On that issue that the caller brought up there, how do you, as a viewer, protect against that? Outside of saying, I'm not going to have my news diet be quite so self-centered on one or two sources.
Well, I think you have to read widely. You have to read aggressively. You have to tune into a lot of different sources. I mean, there's no way around it. And, you know, thankfully, a lot of the monopolies that used to exist on news reporting and news analysis no longer are as formidable. I mean, people can look at the internet. They can, you know, kind of talk radio, NPR affiliates. I mean, there's just a lot more news around. That's not to say there isn't a problem of monopoly news coverage, particularly in the newspaper industry, where, you know, most large to mid-sized cities in America are basically one newspaper towns now, and that's very unfortunate, and it kind of compounds the impact, the problems that are associated with this kind of diversity agenda, because essentially with a one newspaper town, people basically get the news that news organization you know, wants them to, and they have very little alternative, at least in print. Let me just say that Coloring the News does not offer a prescription. You know, I was originally encouraged by my first editor to put together a kind of 12-step recovery program for American journalism, and I shied away from it, and I'm glad I did. I diagnose the problem. I give 200 pages plus of very strong evidence, case studies that illustrate the problem as I see it, which is that this crusade for diversity has run off the rails in its implementation. It was essentially a very historically necessary and well-intentioned effort, but it's run off the rails in the implementation, and the biggest damage is done to the coverage of diversity-related issues like race, gay rights, affirmative action, and immigration.
Okay, let's move on to another caller. Line 2 from Champaign County, you're on with William McGowan.
Hi. At the very beginning, the host had an opening sort of gambit question, which is, you know, give an example. And frankly, I haven't heard a good example yet. You just cited lots of them. And I think there is room to criticize diversity in the press, and I think there's actually it's being manipulated inside of corporations too. Not a simple tokenism, but something approaching that. So I would like to repeat the question. Give an example. You said something about romanticized stories about immigration. I don't see those personally. What I see is a lack of coverage of, you know, the what's really a bleeding wound in North America, which is the whole border between the U.S. and Mexico, where I don't know how many people have died this summer. I know there were a lot last summer. Maybe it's gotten to be a routine number and is obscured by the war on terror or something.
Well, listen, I mean, when you see stories that essentially, you know, get sentimental and so bleeding heart about people illegally crossing the border to come into America, I mean, that is a romantic take on immigration. You yourself, I think, are reflecting a fairly romantic view as opposed to a rigorous analysis of the problems of illegal border crossing. I mean, we have between 5 to 8 million illegal immigrants, and most of them from Mexico in this country. I haven't seen an example of a reporter really exploring the implications of this vast illegal flow, this flood, which is actually a word that is proscribed at many newspapers because, you know, you're not supposed to be negative about immigration, even when you're talking about 5 to 8 million illegal immigrants. But I haven't seen people analyzing, you know, the impact on crime, on criminal justice. I mean, you know, there's a direct connection between illegal immigration and the tragedy of the attack on the trade towers. Yet, you know, we refuse to tie these things together because we get all misty-eyed about, oh, these poor, poverty-stricken Mexicans, or they need a job. The border is this bleeding wound. This is this horrible imposition, you know, this horrible offense against human rights. I mean, come on.
Do you fault the...
No, come on. That's exactly what it is. There are a lot of ways to attack this, and you haven't missed the story that there's an economic dimension to this too.
Yeah, you know what? What you'll never see in the coverage is a blaming of the Mexican elite, the Mexican aristocracy, which basically has been allowed to continue in power by using immigration and particularly illegal immigration as a safety valve on their really pernicious retention of power. If they didn't have that safety valve, if they couldn't shoot 5 to 8 illegal immigrants into America, they'd probably have another revolution, and they'd be brought down in, you know, in their power. So essentially, your view is, you know, it's very well-meaning. I'm sure, you know, it coincides with a whole sort of, you know, kind of very comfortable and tidy package of liberal beliefs. But essentially, you know, this is one of those examples where there are actually illiberal consequences to what might seem to be a very well-meaning liberal goal, immigration or free immigration across borders. And when, you know, you basically have a bunch of really corrupt Mexican oligarchs holding on to power and shooting, you know, their overflow population up here for us to deal with.
Doesn't this all boil down to, Bill, doesn't this all boil down to, though, your perception as author of this book and as a journalist in saying this is what I think news is,
you know,
and
listen,
this
what
is
I've
what
done,
somebody
what
else
I've
does?
What I've done is tried very, very hard to analyze these news issues with, you know, very sort of neutral news judgment and just say, well, where is the story on this? This is not, I'm not saying that this should be policy, this should be the case, but I just want to see stories that are animated by a full sense of an issue and not stories that are animated or pegged to a kind of very sort of liberal perception, you know, on an issue. I mean, I think that there are certainly valid points of debate, you know, either way on issues all the time. I just want to see both sides represented, and I think what I've put together in Coloring the News is a very convincing case that shows that the more conservative side of the argument has been muted and that most news reporters and editors are either actively hostile to those perspectives or unaware of them.
Well, let's pick up another caller, line one from Urbana. You're talking with William McGowan.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Well, I, for one, can tolerate quite a few errors, misjudgments along the way to getting full parity in our newsrooms with full diversity and seeing people that who look like me as anchors, et cetera, et cetera. with stories.
What do you look like, by the way?
I'm Latino.
Okay, I mean, you know, you should sort of let us know that, not just assume that we know what you look like. We're on the radio, remember?
I think it can be surmised from what I'm saying that I don't look like you.
How do you know what I look like?
Well, I think I can guess.
Okay, well, what's your question?
I haven't got a question. I've got a couple of comments here. You keep talking about PC, and when a conservative talks about PC, it just drives me crazy. There's nothing more PC than not being pro-union, for example, in a corporation. There's nothing more PC than not talking about the drug use in prep schools or the Ivy League schools, or about the congressmen and senators' sons who have been let go after they've been caught with drugs, while Joe Blow's son down the street is serving 10 years in prison.
I don't know if
that is PC,
sir. I think what the point you're making is that PC is kind of a facile and somewhat contradictory term. I agree with you. I don't like using that term, but I think when you put finer points on it, as I did, you know, when I first introduced the concept, I think that, you know, when you're talking about ethnic and racial hypersensitivity, kind of group favoritism, cultural relativism, et cetera, I think that adds up to a kind of definition of political correctness, which is actually a shorthand for a much longer, you know, and more complicated view. But, no, I agree. Listen, there's political correctness on the right as well. In certain quarters of conservative America, particularly those dedicated to free market economics, you can't talk about immigration negatively either.
Well, let's talk about the commercialism in the media. Because of the
I don't talk about commercialism. I don't talk about globalization. I don't talk about media conglomeration, because that's another book. Basically, what I talk about in Coloring the News is the impact, the negative adverse impact on coverage of diversity issues and the implications that negative impact has on our broader political culture.
Bill, let's move on, I guess, to a question here that I know has been in the news recently, and this is this rash of child abductions that have come up. Do you see the issue of diversity being a factor at all in the way that's being covered, the fact that for a while it seemed as though the media concentrated on white blonde girls that were missing as opposed to the Milwaukee young black girl that was missing?
Well, listen, I mean, I fully agree with a lot of minority journalists on this issue. I mean, this may sound odd, it may shock you, but I'm not some kind of, you know, hardcore down the line conservative in the least. If anything, I'm a goad to liberal complacency and not a water bearer, a water boy for right wing ideology. And I would say that those that say that there has been disparity in the coverage of these kidnapping cases, that more coverage is given to the little blonde girl in Southern California than to the little black girl in downtown Philadelphia, I'd agree with them. And I'm glad to see that the press has started to correct that a little bit. However, I think, though, that we have to acknowledge that in some cases we're talking apples and oranges. The cases in Southern California generally involve little girls who are sexually molested, and they come out of some kind of predatory and demented sexual pathology on the part of the abductor. In the cases in the inner city, at least the Philadelphia case, for instance, it seemed that case conformed more to a kind of, a hostage, ransom kind of, you know, money-making crime, money-making felony. And I don't necessarily think that this should dictate a difference in the level and intensity of coverage, particularly on a local level. But I do think that it kind of taps into different things. I mean, the Southern California, you know, stories really are, you know, stories that kind of show that the American dream, you know, has a kind of brittle underside, that it can collapse, you know, and there are monsters out there who would, you know, just reach into your home and take your kids. The Philadelphia case and the inner city cases have a little bit more criminality involved. So, I mean, that's just to put a finer point on it. But I do applaud the effort to put as much focus on those cases, because, you know, you're a parent who loses a kid in this way, It's a horrible thing.
It certainly attracted a lot of attention from parents. Again, you're listening to William McGowan. He's the author of Coloring the News, How the Crusade for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism, published by Encounter Books. Again, you can join us, join the conversation from the Champaign-Urbana area at 333-WILL or outside the area at 800-222-WILL. We have a caller patiently waiting on line 3 from Champaign. Go ahead. You're on. You still there? I guess the caller's not with us anymore. Mr. McGowan, tell me again, is the blame here lie with the editors who are telling the reporters what to cover, assigning the stories? Is the fault with the reporters themselves? Is it with the ownership of these major newspapers that kind of dictate and set news policies like the Times and the Post?
You know, it's a hard question to answer in a short period of time. In Coloring the News, I have a whole chapter, chapter 6, which I call Reasons Why, that I explore the reasons why the diversity crusade has run off the rails. And I think all of those that you mentioned are partly responsible. Nobody is solely responsible, but all and more are actually partly responsible. I think that one of the major reasons this diversity crusade has resulted in bad reporting about all things, about diversity, is that there has been actually a lack of appreciation for the value of diversity, and that newsrooms have become increasingly, historically they've always been liberal-leaning, but they've actually become more liberal in the past 10 years or so, and that the definition of diversity is basically only skin deep, and we're not looking at real intellectual diversity or political diversity. And you know, I do affirm a lot of complaints coming from conservative journalists who are a vast minority in newsrooms, who feel that generally they are not given the same value in the shouting match that is kind of, you know, what happens in newsrooms when news judgments are made. Essentially, that their voices have less weight. And that there's, because of that, there's kind of like an invisible liberal consensus that goes unchallenged. It creates kind of, an atmosphere where there are certain givens about society and politics that don't get challenged, and also creates blind spots. So I think that if I had to assign one single reason why diversity has failed, it's because it really hasn't been a diversity of thought and experience. It's basically been a kind of Benetton diversity of skin color, and it's left a lot of people who should be part of the mix, you know, kind of out in the cold.
Well, what about that belief that I think you cite in the book, where it's at one point the press was, a white press for a white reader, and that there have been more and more attempts over the years to not only encourage minority involvement in newsroom, minority reporters, minority editors, but to find a way to reach out to the Latino community and find a way to reach out to the African-American community or the Asian community by adding reporters who know that culture.
Yeah, but the problem is this. It's like you can reach out to these communities of color, these new minority communities, but you don't need to pander to them. And unfortunately, that's what most of the diversity crusade has resulted in. It's resulted in pandering, where they don't want to be as candid or complete. The news reporters and editors can't be as candid as complete because they're afraid of alienating them. They're afraid of boycotts. They're afraid of, that candid and honest reporting is going to be somehow seen as anti-minority. That's a big problem. I think that the effort to reach out, by having minority journalists occupying certain beats, you know, this kind of color-coded assignment policy is often, A, very racist in its own regard, or racialistic to the extent that it believes that skin color ultimately conveys some kind of authority or license to write about or report on certain issues, which it may not necessarily, convey. And secondly, what it winds up, you get a lot of access. I mean, for instance, having Latino immigrants reporting on immigration, where immigrant communities get a lot, you may get a lot more access, but what happens is you lose perspective. I mean, I think there's a clear conflict of interest when you have an immigrant who is assigned to the immigration beat. How could there not be? I mean, that there is an emotional kind of feeling about this, and I think that these kind of conflicts of interest are rife when you start kind of, you know, encouraging the notion that there are certain people in a newsroom by dint of their skin color who are licensed to report or licensed to criticize because of that skin color. I think it's wrong.
You talked at one point in the book about an example of USA Today where I believe I read that at one point the editors of USA Today were actually grading their reporters based on how many racially diverse sources they were quoting in stories.
This happened actually throughout the Gannett empire. USA Today is owned by Gannett. It's one of the 93 daily newspapers.
Doesn't that encourage, though, reporters to reach out beyond their usual sources, which they have in their back pocket?
Well, but it also, you know, it's a good thing for people to reach beyond the usual sources. When I was, a reporter researcher at the McNeil-Lehr Report, we used to joke, every day, call in the usual sources, and and it got to be, kind of comical. And yet, once you start assigning value to a source based on their racial or ethnic or identity or their sexual orientation, you basically are detracting from the expertise of what the source has to say. And I think that, Gannett, what happened was Gannett was really going at this in a totally reporting by the numbers kind of manner. It was a real cookie cutter notion of diversity, where they were basically grading reporters on how many times they would access a minority source bank. Actually, ABC News has a minority source bank now that they're encouraging, their producers and bookers to use. And I think what it does is it does a number of things. It detracts from the seriousness of the news coverage. If reporters get the idea that it's less important for a source to be knowledgeable than for a source to be black or Latino, then I think the quality of the analysis suffers. But also it kind of encourages just some really bizarre notions of in readers themselves. Why do readers have to know? We don't identify the race of a source unless the race is pertinent. So why are we kind of, accenting or encouraging reporters to have these sources of color if we're not really going to let people know who they are?
Let me bring up one other example you bring up in the book, and I'll have you go into more detail about it. And that concerns the coverage of the Matthew Shepard case in Wyoming that I think you write is distorted because of diversity. And you contrast that, though, with the death of the Arkansas boy.
Right. Well, what I say about the Matthew Shepard case, Matthew Shepard was a young homosexual man in Wyoming who was brutally attacked by two thugs and left to die tied to a fence post in sub-freezing temperatures. I think it was back in 1999. That story, I think quite properly, became a nationwide media sensation, although it probably was a little bit of overkill to it. But not long after the Shepard case, there was a 13-year-old Arkansas boy named Jesse Durkheising who was sadistically raped for hours and left to die by his two next-door neighbor homosexuals. And that story, which got absolutely no attention at all by national news organizations such as the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, CNN, CBS, and NBC. I make the point that I don't think the Durkheising case deserved the parity of coverage that the Matthew Shepard case got, but it certainly deserved some national attention. Because here's the situation. We have Matthew Shepard, who is a young homosexual man who was, brutally attacked by two homophobic thugs, but here's Jesse Durkheising, who was sadistically attacked by two homosexual thugs, and there's no reporting. Somewhere there was room for reporting on the Jesse Durkheising case, and the reason why there wasn't reporting on it was that it confirmed very long-standing and pernicious stereotypes of gay pedophilia, and I think that this was really at the root of why a lot of news editors stayed away from the story.
You don't think it was the hate element in the Shepard case that may not have existed in the Arkansas case?
Well, I don't think you can argue that the hate element existed in the Arkansas case, but that's not the only reason why a story should get reported. I mean, the hate element was an important part of the Matthew Shepard case, but there are other elements that are part of the Jesse Durkheising case that are certainly worthy of serious news analysis. I mean, Andrew Sullivan, who's a noted conservative yet gay columnist, wrote a really, interesting piece for the New Republic about this. And, basically it sounded like Jesse Durkheising probably had gay tendencies, and his mother encouraged him to spend time with who she thought were positive gay role models, unfortunately. And Andrew Sullivan said, this is interesting, this says a lot about the homosexual community. I mean, the emphasis on sex with the young, what's going on there, the emphasis on kind of gay mentors. There were very, very serious newsworthy pegs to write about and report on the Jesse Dierkhuizen case, the media just ignored them because they were afraid of all the other stereotypes that they thought they would be encouraging.
You write that circulation at newspapers is down, and that's one of the big signs that this diversity plan, somewhat pushed very stringently at the Unity Conference, just isn't working. But couldn't there be dozens of reasons that circulation is down and diversity, in fact, maybe one, but isn't the big reason?
Well, no, I don't say that diversity is the sole reason at all. I mean, there are many other reasons why newspaper readership is down. I mean, I personally think the appalling state of public education in this country is one of the reasons why we're creating a generation that just, you know, doesn't read and has no civic engagement at all. Diversity, however, it's interesting because it was really looked at by the newspaper industry and the broadcast industry as kind of a salvation for the erosion of readers and viewers. And the idea was, the expectation was that you were going to reach out to new communities of color, new minorities, blacks, and particularly, you know, Latinos, and you were somehow going to bring them into the fold, and you were going to staunch the erosion in the white middle class by replacing, you know, these kind of fallen by the wayside readers and viewers with these new minority, you know, news consumers. There has been a total failure in terms of reaching out to new minority communities here. There was an analysis in the Columbia Journalism Review a couple of years ago called "The Myth of the Minority Reader," and in it, you know, somebody actually went through, you know, the demographic figures, the circulation figures, and pretty convincingly argued that, in fact, minority news consumers, you know, have not been terribly thrilled or persuaded by the so-called diversity journalism of the 90s and really haven't risen to, you know, the call, and, you know, are simply, you know, the whole assumption just hasn't worked out.
Again, we are joined today on the Afternoon Magazine by William McGowan. He is the author of Coloring the News, How Crusading for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism, published by Encounter Books. We've been talking about how the crusade for diversity in many newsrooms across America, especially at the New York Times and Washington Post, has influenced the way stories, certain stories are being reported today. Overall, do you think that the press today is doing a good enough job being a watchdog for society? I mean, I know much of your book is focused on certain media outlets that you studied more intensively, but what's your general view of the rest of us that are trying to report the news?
You know, I'm a little disturbed about just how taken from behind the press has been on several big stories, recent stories. The 9/11, you know, the immigration implications of 9/11, I think it's really, really shameful that the media, it took something like 9/11 for, you know, really strong, rigorous reporting about the holes and weaknesses in the immigration system to get done. I think, you know, I'm not blaming the media for 9/11 in the least, but I think if had there been less ideologically pro-immigrant sentiment in newsrooms, you might have been able to get stories through the pipeline that would have illuminated or underscored, you know, the lapses and weaknesses in the immigration net that the terrorists were able to exploit. I'm a little, you know, taken aback by, you know, stories like fraud in the auditing system and weaknesses in the accounting system, you know, where you had a lot of the business press was basically, you know, playing cheerleader for this big stock market bubble and really wasn't paying attention to the nitty-gritty of accounting procedures. I'm taken aback by how resistant the press has been to the homosexual subtext to the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal.
In fact, that was something I was going to ask. What's your view of that? Do you think that the press has been protective, I guess, of the Catholic Church?
Yes, I do. Unfortunately, gay men in society at large are not more likely to abuse teenage boys than any other segment, you know, of society. But gay Catholic priests do seem, based on the evidence, I mean, 80 to 85% of the cases that have come to light in this recent, you know, Catholic Church sex abuse scandal involve priests basically abusing teenage boys, not children of either gender, but teenage boys. So I think that, you know, it kind of suggests obviously that this is a problem less of pedophilia, you know, kind of, you know, pathological pedophilia than it is irresponsible homosexuality. And yet most of the media doesn't want to go there. I mean, it took months before
because it's a taboo topic, or?
Yeah, I do. I think that basically a lot of the news media is very protective toward the homosexual community in America and very protective to, you know, what might be called, you know, a gay political agenda, so to speak. I think the gay community can protect itself quite well, thank you very much, and doesn't really need this patronizing kind of anxious coverage, and doesn't need that protective instinct. But there is this sense somehow that America, you know, largely is horribly homophobic, and you don't want to scapegoat gays, you know. And it's really amazing, you know, just how slow the press was to acknowledge at all that most of these guys doing this, most of the cases involved, you know, homosexual exploitation, and just how quickly they were ready to transfer blame to the institutional structure of the church, and even then not really to kind of acknowledge that a lot of reasons why the bishops and cardinals had covered up for these guys for years, in addition to, you know, some doing it out of, you know, sort of misplaced clerical compassion for colleagues, a lot of the higher-ups had skeletons in their closet, too, that there was this whole notion of gay blackmail coming out, you know, in towards bishops and cardinals who were going to discipline, you know, those priests who had abused teenage boys.
Let me again invite listeners to phone in their questions for William McGowan at 333-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area and outside the Champaign-Urbana area at 800-222-9455. Mr. McGowan, again, Journalism 101, I think, pretty much teaches every rookie reporter how to be fair, ethical, honest, and unbiased. Is there a problem in the system where journalists are first being trained and exposed?
Yeah,
is this
probably the assumption that Journalism 101 can, and that alone, can teach you to be fair, balanced, and honest.
That's the practices I think most journalism professors would try to instill in their young students.
It's a lifelong learning process. And look, I don't want to come off as some kind of like overly judgmental scold, but I do think there is a problem in journalism education to the extent that most journalism schools in America are horribly infected by that awful term again, political correctness. You can't get a good debate. We could not debate this whole sort of gay dimension to the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal in a journalism school in America. I will take an invitation from any journalism program out there to debate that coverage, but I'll bet nobody would have me because it's just too taboo. Journalism schools have lost sight of just how far they have become completely colonized by this kind of proper thinking, left liberal vision of the world.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is that?
Well, I think they're self-selecting. I mean, I think, you know, academia in general is beset by that problem, and I think journalism schools, even though, you know, journalism schools would like to see themselves as, you know, kind of maverick outsiders within an academic community. I mean, essentially, you know, basically, or it's contagious. they're going to reflect that same kind of liberal orthodoxy in the political thinking that reigns there. I do think that it's probably an even worse problem than the newsroom. It's probably not as important to understand because I think journalism schools are largely irrelevant to most of the real moving and shaking that gets done in the media.
Let's take a caller, line one from Champaign. You're on with William McGowan.
Hello.
Yes,
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I've been listening to this, and, you know, when somebody starts going on and on about political correctness, I automatically know what, you know, base camp this person is coming from, because political correctness is always left liberal. But,
well, if you know what base camp I'm coming from, you obviously haven't read the book, because you'll see that, you know, particularly in the last chapter when I examine the consequences of this kind of diversity journalism on American politics and society, I basically lament the implications it's had for the tradition, the very great tradition of progressive thinking in this country and progressive politics. So I come at it more from a very concerned progressive point of view than from any kind of, you know, sort of solidly right-wing conservative base camp.
Well, then it's really a shame that you use a catchphrase that is so associated
I use it as a total shorthand, and when I use it, I apologize for it in advance. It is, for lack of a better term, but I will say that I think there is a total resistance on the part of people who, you know, have such knee-jerk, you know, sort of reactions to that term that essentially I can identify where with the base camp most people are coming from pretty easily from it.
Well, what made me decide to call is when you started talking about, you know, this whole business of the priests in the Catholic Church, you know, who have had sex with boys.
Yeah.
And maybe I live on a different news planet from you, but in almost all the at least print coverage that I saw, you know, I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Newsweek, things like that. When the bishops were talking about what do we do, we're going to come down on a homosexual priest, and every newspaper kept saying, you know, it's the problem is they're not dealing with little boys. They're dealing with these teenagers, you know. And a lot of people were trying to make, a lot of the writers that I read kept trying to make the point that this really is a homosexual problem.
Well, you know, we do live on different news planets because it took 3 months into the scandal before the New York Times even acknowledged that some people were saying that homosexuality was a subtext to these abuse cases. I remember reading the big cover package that Newsweek put together, and I did not see that, you know, Newsweek acknowledged that most of these victims were teenage boys, not prepubescent children. So I think you're the one who needs to go back and read the coverage a little bit and see that, you know, my conclusions essentially are based on very close day-to-day textual analysis of what gets reported and what doesn't. And, you know, even when they did start admitting that, you know, a lot of these cases involved gay priests hitting on teenage boys, you still saw a tremendous hostility without any real consideration for the complexity or for the factual basis. You saw a tremendous hostility to when the bishops said, look, you know, we need to sort of, you know, maybe examine what's going on in seminaries. We need to revisit the question of whether gay men should be ordained or not. I mean, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, every media outlet that reported this, every mainstream media outlet was instantly went into, don't scapegoat gays. I'm not saying that gays shouldn't be ordained, but I think in the face of this abundance of evidence that shows that there's some dysfunction in the clerical culture and that gay priests are very much a part of that dysfunction, that it's certainly legitimate to debate the propriety of ordaining gay men.
Let me step in here because we've come to the end of the program today. We want to send our thanks out to you, William McGowan, the author of Coloring the News, How Crusading for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism. Thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and hear your views about diversity in the media.
Well, thank you very much. You know, the book has a website, www.coloringthenews.com, and I think any readers or any listeners out there who want to get, you know, deeper into the complexity of the issue would find it very enjoyable. They could also buy the book anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Okay, thank you. Bill McGowan
you
about Coloring the News.